Thank you. How did enclosure, these processes of enclosure within England and Europe, shape colonization of the Americas? And more specifically, on the ground, how did the dynamics of commons and enclosure change in the North American context, where landless Europeans participated in brutal settler colonial violence, part of this murderous process subjecting Black and Indigenous commons to their own enclosures?
Yeah, this is a complex question over several centuries and with a lot of different languages involved, different countries involved, because it takes place at the same time that the nation state is being formed, which is an engine of widespread enclosure in England. You know, remember Henry VIII, dissolution of the monasteries, Kett's rebellion, and so on. The whole age of Tudor disorder comes about because of enclosure. So an obvious way of getting out of this for the English ruling class is to export people. And the necessitous surplus population, I think, is an Elizabethan phrase. And the first sailors that went to North Carolina, you remember the whole myth of the lost colony. It's not a myth. These are people from England who join Native American communities and are welcomed by them. That's the history of the lost colony of Roanoke. So that's an important dynamic, I think, Dan, for us to remember, and especially for us historians to search out, because there's a huge realm. And this, I think, is also necessary for class politics to maintain settler colonialism. The violence of conquest requires preventing English sailors, Irish, Welsh, Scottish proletarians who'd lost their subsistence in the British Isles. There must be disincentives against joining Native American people. And that's why the frontier is this like border of fire, why it's a zone of maximum violence, of maximum torture. So an important part of the frontier is to maintain this. It's easy to imagine it as being a wall of fire. Anyway, that's I think an important dynamic, but it's secondary to the larger dynamic that you mentioned, which is conquest. You know, when we think of the American Revolution of 1776 and so on, those soldiers will be paid in a script that's redeemable by land claims in the Ohio Valley. So there, the form of money is also a form of expropriation of native people. Going back in history, you know, from 1776, let's go to 1626. And there we have a very startling and little known episode in the history of Turtle Island, where Thomas Morton from England and his companions celebrated May Day, the 1st of May, with the Native Americans in what's now Quincy, Massachusetts. Nathaniel Hawthorne in later years will write about it, but this rainbow coalition, as we might say, is suppressed by invasions from Boston led by the Puritan commanders, Bradford and others, who come and put a fire, take down the maypole, remove any kind of Anglo-Native convivialities or community. That's called the Maypole of Marymount, the May Day of Marymount in 1626. So these are small episodes that like open a door to, well, to the imagination as it did with Nathaniel Hawthorne, but also to the historian as a places of investigation. And surely these are needed now, these keyholes into the past to unlock a different story, to unlock another story besides the endless ethnic essentialism and the inherent violence of white supremacy. White supremacy has to be taught, and it has to be continually taught. So it goes under the name of civilization versus savagery. But this flies in the face of the experience of those on the ground. And again, to understand this, it's best to take an economic class viewpoint towards it. It's not just a matter of ethnicity or of Europe versus America. It has to do with the conquistador, the rulers, who are as fierce and torturous and violent to those who serve them, their workers, their peasants, which isn't to say that all workers and peasants are, you know, rushing off into Haiti or Saint-Domingue or Peru with open arms, but it's just to say that as a matter of practical subsistence, an alliance is always and often possible between the indigenous people and the proletarians of Europe. See, capitalism on the ruling class will always organize its institutions of church, education, to say that their rule is inevitable and eternal, that there's no alternative than to the world that they prescribe. So to have the ability to say that another world is possible, in the case of Karl Marx and those who preceded him, is to have had some knowledge of other worlds.
What do we gain by viewing this process of settler colonialism through this shared lens of enclosure?
Well, what we gain is we see that a unity in the process of the creation of a working class in Europe and a working class in colonies. And settlement is only a process of expropriation and then of divvying up the spoils. So there's a powerful history of the working class in South Africa among white proletarians that is largely unknown. In India, you know, I'm familiar with Irish soldiers who revolted against their English masters and helped produce the first editions of Tom Paine in India. Remember Kim's, in Rudyard Kipling's novel, Kim, his father was Irish. So I think there's a tendency to think of settler colonialism in strictly racial terms or ethnic terms. Those terms are fundamental for sure, just like gender differences are fundamental, because throughout this whole process of enclosure is the enclosure of the woman's body and the loss of her sovereignty as a human being. As the proletarians will hang high on the gallows, they will burn fierce at the stake, which is where women healers, women nurses, women healthcare workers ended up under the name of witchcraft. So what I want us to see is a similar process that will take place in Calcutta and in London, that will take place in Boston and in Bristol, a similar process of enclosure. But it's a deep question, and it's not done with. It's not over. You know, you think of the Red Nation here in Turtle Island. The Red Nation is leading the protection against ICE in Minneapolis, you know, the Southside Minneapolis Native population. The Red Nation demands land back. So when I say the process is not over, that's what I'm referring to, is the struggle against expropriation is also a struggle against exploitation. And the whole discourse of extractivism has to begin with extracting the labor from the conquered at home and abroad, I was going to say. You know, I'm not satisfied with that bifurcation because I want to live with the international. Arise, ye workers of starvation. Arise, ye wretched of the earth. Those are the words that come to mind as soon as I say at home and abroad. You know, it's not a tourist trap. It's not a winter vacation to the Caribbean. Right now, it's death in the Caribbean. We don't know the names of the 112, 115 people who have been blown up, the fishermen, the small boat owners, by the American juggernaut, the American war machine. We know the name of Renee Nicole Good, but not the name of those others. And we need those names because they will come here and they will be asked for their papers and who is going to defend them. Whatever you might say about the ecological or environmental movement, it's helped us see the world as a planet. And on the planet, human beings are moving. And we've always been moving as wanderers on the planet, you know, going back to the beginnings of enclosure, going back earlier as the vagabond, the beggar, the person who crosses frontiers. So in other words, Dan, I'm looking in the past for examples to show that another world is possible. And that's why I'm more interested in Mary Houghton than I am in Lord Cornwallis. I'm more interested in her life and her family life than in his. Because as you say, you know, he brought private property to Ireland, he brought private property to India, and he brought it, you know, on the head of Mary Houghton and her husband after the defeat at Yorktown. Thank you.
Thank you. listening to music is the substance. I'm up for that. Thanks for being here.